Okay. Hello, everybody. Welcome back. Excited to learn with you again. So just a quick review of where we've come, because it's been a long time. We had a weekend in between. We learned the first class about the structure of the Amidah on High Holidays, specifically on Rosh Hashanah, which doesn't have 18 blessings. It doesn't have 7 blessings like Shabbat or Chag. Has 9 blessings in Musaf, okay? And that's the Malchiyot, Zichronot, Shofarot. But Malchiyot's paired with Kedushat HaYom, right? So the blessing of the day, the holiness of the day, plus Malchiyot comes together. And my argument was that Malchiyot is late to the game. It's the added element of Rosh Hashanah Musaf that is the more celebratory side, less of the emergency Zichronot, Shofarot approach. That was the big structure of the Amidah. Then last time, we looked at Avinu Malkeinu, which, as we saw from the narratives, is actually a substitute for the Amidah, or maybe it's the icing on the cake. We couldn't quite figure out if it's instead of or in addition to. And that was also an opportunity to explore how spontaneous prayer can balance out the way in which the set prayer is meant to function. And also, who is the davener matters. So when you're praying for rain, Rabbi Eliezer, not a crier, you want to go with Rabbi Akiva, the guy who, through the force of his own tears, can cause other people to cry, embodies the Ma'avir al Midotav. He passes over his anger, and he embodies the chesed, the loving kindness that we want God to show us. So we saw the main structure of the Amidah. That was the first session. And then the what do you do when the Amidah doesn't work, Avinu Malkeinu, that's the second section. Now, what we're going to look at today is one of the most controversial prayers in Jewish life, which is Unetana Tokef, which has the who shall live and who shall die, who by fire, who by water, which is the name of this book that was published by Jewish Lights and edited by Larry Hoffman, which is a collection of essays about Unetana Tokef. Not a lot of prayers will generate their own book. So there's something to this prayer. And we're going to have the opportunity to actually dive in, look at it, try to understand how it works, but also, as a corollary, understand how it itself is a representative of many other prayers in the Machzor, all trying to answer the question, why am I about to spend 6 to 12 hours in Shul? How come I can get away with 2 hours or 2.5 or 3, but I'm moving to make that illegal on Shabbat, but I have to spend double or triple the amount of time on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. And this is because there's a certain addition to the Amidah that Unetana Tokef is representative of. So before we dive into the text, I just want to explain to you the structure, okay? So if you remember the structure of the Amidah, we've got our little bracket here. We've got 3 at the beginning and 3 at the end. And then you have the middle, which is the content, okay? Now, that itself would take some additional time, but let's be honest. 9 blessings, even with a whole bunch of verses in the middle of them, doesn't take a tremendous amount of time. So, why are we spending so much time? Or to put it another way, why is the Machzor 1,200 pages, okay? That is because there is an additional element to the structure of the Amidah that shows up on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. And this is, where's Marion? Marion. PU team, this is your moment, okay? PU team are religious poems that were inserted into the middle of the structure of the Amidah, okay? So there is a system of poetry that interlocks with the Amidah structure. The Amidah structure remains the same, but on top of that, layered on, is a system of poems. Okay, and here's how it works. You've got one poem after the first blessing, one poem after the second blessing. Actually, the way it really works is this. Let's say this is a blessing, okay? You've got the content of the blessing, then you've got the poem, which is usually much longer, and then you've got the very last line of the blessing, okay? So you've got the content, which is known as the guf, the body, and then you've got the piyut, the poem. And then you've got the Chatima, which is the Baruch Atah Adonai, blessed are you, God. That's just the structure, okay? Content of the blessing, poem, and then the end of the blessing. Yeah.
Quick question. What the blessings are prayers, understood why they're in the prayer. Poems are poems. Why are they there? Just
why are the poems there in the first place?
Or?
Okay, good. So what's wrong with just this? Why do you have to add a poem? So part of the answer to that is, actually, the way this used to work is that, and this is radical, so get ready, okay? It used to be that not that you had A plus B, but actually you had B instead of A, okay? So in other words, you would just cross off the normal, regular text of the Amidah. You would keep the blessing, that remains constant, but the poem was a substitute for the regular content of the blessing. And actually the artistry of the leader of the prayers was somebody who could either memorize or recite this poem or probably write the poem, right? So would you like to lead Musaf next week? Let me think about it. I have to go to my writer's retreat and work out a poem. That's what it means to lead Musaf. If you have a nice voice, okay, right? But the idea is that it's a artistic creation, and the public Amida is the recitation of that artistic creation. So it's like, it's a way of bringing your unique voice to prayer in a way that we often don't think of the mosque. We think of it as like very, very set. You don't make any adjustments. Maybe you'll change like one letter. But this is like a total substitution. But thank God, it was so controversial that they said, you know what? We're not going to cross out this section. We're going to make you add it, okay? And now the Machzor jumps from 600 to 1,200 pages, just like that, okay? Now, is that good? We're good?
Yeah, but just when did this happen?
Okay, so this is another question of how old are piyutim? How old are religious poems? So it's a big scholarly debate, but I'll sum it up for you in one sentence, which is it seems like the oldest poets who were doing this are 5th, 6th century. Okay, the first named poet who's doing this is a guy, great, top 5 names in Jewish history, Yossi ben Yossi. Okay? Yossi ben Yossi is the first named author of poems, and it seems like he lives late 5th, early 6th century. Okay, so you're talking about the end of the rabbinic period. Okay, that's and you'll see the poems not only draw upon the Bible, but also on rabbinic other earlier rabbinic midrashim. So, and it's taking place in Eretz Yisrael. One of the great discoveries that the Geniza in Cairo yielded for us was thousands and thousands of these poems that were hanging out in the Eretz Yisrael tradition that the Bavel people, which all of us Jews extant today are descended from the Bavel tradition, they ran it out of town. They were like, maybe you can get away with adding, but we're not going to let you substitute anymore. So the whole, and by the way, to say one other thing, this is not, in old times in Eretz Yisrael, this was not just on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, it was every Shabbat. Every Shabbat, the leader would get up and pray an original poem that would be connected to the Torah portion and would be inserted into the Amidah like this. Cross out the regular goof, which maybe you'd say in your private Amidah, and say something about the Parsha in their repetition of the Amidah. Some think that it's instead of the sermon. Like that was the way they taught, was this poetic way. Okay, good. One more word on the structure, then we're gonna dive into the content. So you've got one of these poems that lead into the first blessing. One of them leads into the second blessing. And then you've got, oops, wrong one. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 poems that lead into the third blessing. Okay? Now we're seeing how this is getting long. Okay, so it was a cycle of 10 poems that would culminate in the third blessing, Kedusha. Okay? This structure, the blue, these 10 poems, are called Akrova. There's a midrash that says, when you're meant to lead the davening, don't say to the leader, Bovi Palel, come and do tefillah, but rather, Bovi Karev, come and Karev, which either means to draw near, or to do battle, or something along those lines. But that's probably where the name Krova comes from. So Krovel was a system of poems that were inserted into the first three blessings, heavily weighted to the third blessing, which ends with Kedusha. Okay? Now, each of these poems, not all of them, but some of them have their own names, like technical names. And we're not going to go through all 10 of them, but the last one, number 10, is called, the name of the poem is called the Siluk. Listalek is to go up, la'alot. And that's the last one that you go up to heaven and then recite Kedusha. So the last poem in the series is supposed to get you to the heavenly gates where you're imitating the angels and about to recite the Kedusha. And that's where our poem is going to show up. That is to say, when Tana Tokev, who by fire, who shall live and who shall die, who by fire, who by water, is the 10th poem in a 10-poem cycle that ends with Kedusha, and its purpose is to sort of get us there, okay? So that's the structure where this falls into. Marion.
Okay, I just want to clarify for a second. So we have the first blessing, then we have one peach. Then we have the second blessing, then we have eight peaches. Then we have the third blessing, and then we have...
Sorry, not exactly. First blessing, in which we insert one poem. Second blessing, we insert one poem. Third blessing, we insert eight poems. Then you go to Kedusha, and then you get your end. Baruch Atah Hashem, HaMelech HaKadosh. That's the end of the third blessing. Okay? Yeah, Gabi.
Is Siluk the name of a category of poem, or is this, there's only one Siluk in this eight, and that's the Natanah? Like, is this 118, does that ever happen on Shabbos, or this only happens?
So the 118 is called Krova, that's the Krova system, and that also happens on Shabbat. Not anymore. But it would like they would use this style also on Shabbat. And Siluk is the technical name for the last poem. So Unatana Tokev is a type of Siluk, but not the only one. Okay. Any other thoughts on the structure? We're good? Yeah, what's that?
I would have thought that the Piyutim were to get us ready for the blowing of shofar in Musaf, as opposed to Kedusha, which is three times a day, 365. So why do we need something to get us to a place that we are always?
Okay, good. You're raising an important point, which is, hold on, these poems are actually leading us up to something that we know very well. There's one last piece of the story, which is, in Eretz Yisrael, the Kedusha, which we now recite every time we repeat the Amidah, like we just had Mincha Yer, we recited the Kedusha. In Eretz Yisrael, the Kedusha was only recited once a week and on holidays, just in Shacharit. Okay? So it was a very special experience. By the way, if you were late for Shul, like now it's like you show up for Torah reading. I'm giving you the benefit of the doubt. Okay? And back then it was like, if you showed up for Torah reading, you missed the main event. The main event was the piyut cycle that would end in Kedusha that you would then get to experience, and you wouldn't be able to experience that until next Shabbat. So, and that's why also this is a system that's not just on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, but it's every Shabbat, and it leads into sort of the highlight mystical experience of the service. And that's where the piyut team are driving. Yeah?
I mean, if you already covered this, I was just curious, why are the 10 poems integrated into the blessings of the Amidah instead of just before or after?
Yeah, so again, they were originally a substitute for the beginning of the blessing, and they would just cross it out. But then later the traditionalists said, you can't substitute. If you want to add, you can add, but you're not going to be able to cross out anything.
I was asking actually why let's say you want to have those 10 piyutim, like why not just say the Amidah and then say the 10 piyutim, not as a substitute, but in addition to that, like, but at the end, not in
at the end. Right. There are some places that try to work out a version of that.
Okay.
Because once you disconnect it from its original function, which was really to lead into the blessing, but in a new and creative way, well, then you can move it around, right? It's like, I don't know, it's not really connected in an organic way. But the reason it's sort of stuck here in most places is because that's where it really was meant. It was meant to lead into the end of the blessing. So if you took this out and put it at the end, it sort of loses its force. That's where it's driving. Okay, good? We're at least, if nothing else, now you know why we're in Shul for a long time. Okay? Now, I want to explore with you this particular piyut, which is the Siluk of Unatana Tokef. And What I'm going to give us the opportunity to do is to actually spend some time reading it. And we're going to understand how these poems work. Like, what's the literary style of the poem? Okay? Okay. So here's what I'm going to offer to you as an opportunity to do. The song itself, the poem, runs page 1, page 2, and a tiny bit of page 3. That's the poem, okay? And in a moment, I'm going to ask you to run through that poem and just have an opportunity to spend some time with the words. I'll just say, by the way, as a metaphor for what Rosh Hashanah is, I want to tell you the experience I had this morning, which is I woke up and I looked at my watch, and I was 9 minutes ahead of schedule when I woke up. So I took this book that I was meant to be reading, which is the You Are Uncomplete. My game is it's a game of inches in our house. 9 minutes is a huge, huge windfall. So This Is Real and You Are Completely Unprepared, the Alan Liu book. So I was like, great, I got 9 minutes. I can read the Slicho chapter. And then I realized that my watch was slow by 9 minutes. So I had the horrible experience, this meta experience of reading a book called This Is Real and You're Completely Unprepared, and also recognizing that I thought I had all this time, but actually I'm late. That's High Holidays, okay? Right, that's the emotional experience which I had this morning. So I don't know if this actually works. We'll find out. Okay, so we're gonna actually spend some time reading the poem. I have my phone, it's good, yeah. But I want to invite us one way into the poem, just to start off, to at least highlight a literary question about the poem. Okay? In order to do that, I'm going to ask you to turn over to page 3. Okay? If you turn over to page 3, you'll see a midrash that has a line that may sound familiar to you from this poem. Amar Rabbi Yehuda Rabbi Shalom, B'shem Rabbi Eliezer. Rabbi Yehuda, son of Rabbi Shalom, said in the name of Rabbi Eliezer, Shlosha devarim mivatlin gzeira kasha. There are three things that mivatlin, that cancel a harsh decree. They are v'eluhain, teshuva, utfila, utzedaka. Repentance, prayer, and charity. Okay? Teshuva, tefila, and tzedaka. So the literary question that I have is, do we know this from our poem, from Unatana Zogeth? We do. But it's okay to forget, because it was a long time ago. It was actually almost exactly a year ago when we last said it. So let's just remind ourselves, how is it said in the poem itself? Look over at page 2, in the bold. Uteshuva utefila utzedaka, ma'virin et roa hagzera. Cause the roa hagzera, the evilness of the decree, to pass. Okay? The translation here is Joel Hoffman, which I think is a nice translation. It's the translation in this book. Okay? Tshuva tefila tzedaka ma'avirin et roa gzeira. So a literary question I'm asking you is, why would the author of the poem take a midrash that says these three things cancel the harsh decree, mivatlin, and turn it into a different formulation, which is ma'avirin? Right? Cause the roa hagzera, cause the evilness of the gzera, of the decree, to pass. Okay? In other words, he's clearly quoting tshuva, tefila, and tzedakah. He knows the midrash, but he's using a different word than the one that's in the midrash. He's choosing ma'avirin to cause to pass, as opposed to mivatlin to cancel. Okay, does the question make sense? He could have just said, Uchuva utfilo tzedaka mivatlin at roa gzera, right? Doesn't hurt the meter, okay? So why make that switch? Okay, that's one literary question I'm putting out there. The other guidance that I want to give you as you're reading through the poem is just to ask questions. That is to say, what's not clear? What's strange? What doesn't make sense? What would I like to find out more about? As a way of just entering the process of interpreting the poem itself. Okay? So you can come up with answers to your own questions, but really it's an opportunity to just ask questions about the prayer. So we're gonna take some time to read it. And so it runs again from page 1, page 2, and the very top lines in page 3. If you don't get through the whole poem, you probably won't get through the whole poem. That's fine. okay? To spend a little more time with a few words is okay, okay? So we're going to take some time. I'm going to advise you to pair up into groups of twos, okay? If you have an odd number, you can do threes. Read it out loud. Ask as many questions as you can about it. Okay, we're going to bring it back together here. I want to hear from you some of your... some of the things you noticed, questions, stuff that came up for you. If you didn't get through the whole poem, three times to do it. First day, second day Rosh Hashanah, and Yom Kippur. Now you're excited. And I would say, by the way, the poem was so popular, even though it was originally part of the Rosh Hashanah liturgy, they like brought it back for Yom Kippur because people wanted to say it again. Or I don't know, they were glutton for punishment, depending on how you feel about the poem. But you'll get it three times. Okay, what did you... what did you notice? What came up for you? Yeah, please.
As Jen was just saying, there are sort of these groups of metaphors. The first is the metaphor of the legal system metaphor with judge, jury, court reporter, etc. Then we have the metaphor of the book of memory that is brought out. Is it the video that's played? We have a video of your entire life this past year, and we're going to play it right now in front of the jury. Mm. And then the third one is at the beginning here, is the shepherd, whose flock passes underneath the shepherd's crook, and the shepherd said, okay, living another year, dying.
Good, okay, so you're already pointed to the way in which the poem moves us through different experiences of metaphors. And perhaps that will also raise different emotions. By the way, on the videotape thing, there is an amazing midrash running through the different biblical characters who essentially, once in the midrash, once they realize that their actions are being recorded in the Torah, they say, like Reuven says, oh, if I knew that you were going to write down the actions that I was doing in the Torah, I might have treated my brother a little bit differently. It's amazing. It's like, what do I need? What incentive do you need if you were, you know, broadcast on reality TV your whole life? Would you behave differently? And that's one of the things you were pointing to. Yeah, got it.
One interesting juxtaposition of images was the very beginning when it says, the power of this day, for it is awesome and dreadful, and your throne will be established in loving kindness. Kind of an interesting change of pace there.
Yeah, it's interesting because a lot of Rosh Hashanah is trying to convince God. It's actually the purpose of the shofar, according to the rabbis, or one purpose of the shofar is to convince God to move from the kisei, from the throne of din, or synonym emet, truth or straight line rule, to chesed. Right, we saw that last time, Rabbi Ezer, who sort of represents din versus Rabbi Akiva, represents chesed. And so normally you're moving from emet to chesed, or din to chesed, but here, actually, yes, you have these scary terms, and then you have the ikon bechesed kisecha, your throne is established in chesed, v'teshev elav be'emet, but you're going to sit in it in truth. That is to say, it's going the opposite of the way you want it to be moving. You want it to be that you're on the throne of truth, and then you'll move to the throne of chesed, and I'm feeling better. That is to say, it's they're not denying that there's a chesed element to God, but they're sort of saying that it's, at least at this point in the poem, that's understated. Chesed is a temporary state where emet then supersedes it, even though the whole purpose of Rosh Hashanah is to try to go the other way. So if you're sort of trying to raise up fear and the Nora element of Yamim Noraim, we're talking about that term, right? The what's called days of awe, but really days of terror, you could also translate it. It's like that's a terror-inducing image, and there's more of that in the beginning here. Yeah, Benji.
Where it gets to the Dubai, sort of controversial.
The bottom of page one. Good.
I think like the controversy, like intuitively a lot of these things seem pretty out of our control. Is the suggestion that are in our control, either from the beginning where we're doing all year or by Tefillah, Tshuva, Tzedakah, or are those just happening side by side? Just like how much of this do we have in control? Was this right?
Good. Okay, so the list, the famous list of who by X and who by Y, is it meant to be comprehensive? What are they trying to cover? We were saying, is it types of capital punishment and also psychological approaches, you know, who will wander versus who will stay stationary can be a psychological state, whereas who will be decapitated and who will drown, it's more of a physical state. And sort of what are we going for there? Is it all terror? Is it trying to get it more things? And how am I supposed to mitigate that? Is tshuva, tefillah, and tzedakah sort of like a magic armor around that? And what if, like, I tried that and it didn't work? By the way, is it all of them? Or can you do either, any of them? Do you have to do, you know, all three? Is that why we keep going back to shul? Because it's like one third of the formula? Or if it's like, you know what? If you give $5, you don't have to go to shul this year. It's either or, okay? You know, it's not totally clear from the wording here. Okay, yeah, Ariel.
Oh, we were just talking about how a lot of these, like anyone with any degree of literacy or illiteracy can identify with and understand. And it seems like there's so much variation in terms of like abstraction and all of the different prayers. And this is like a very visceral.
This is like
the most visceral
you can get. I have news for all of us. Every, as my friend says, none of us is getting out of here alive. Okay? It's like we all know about this. And so now this is really meant to focus you on that sort of, to face our own mortality, and which, I, by the way, is the general project, I think, of certainly Yom Kippur, where you literally stop eating, dress up in your funeral shrouds, and, you know, move about as if you are dead. And even though there's a Rosh Hashanah song, but you can see why it works for Yom Kippur. And you're saying it's like very simple. Mi yichyeh mi yamut. You don't need a lot of literacy background to get that question, who shall live and who shall die? You wanted to add?
Oh, yeah. I was saying, we were always kind of comparing it with kind of different, like, cultural approaches to death and how this, like, really, like, comes into, like, Jewish death anxiety. And, like, kind of... that's not exactly how it was framed. But, like, comparing it with, like, death poems and kind of, like, different, like, approaches to that.
Good. So what's the particular angle of the Jewish approach to death that comes out in this poem? Okay, David.
We were puzzled in what looks like the bottom paragraph, I'm not sure, midway down the first page in English, and they will say, "Behold the day of judgment for reviewing the hosts of high in judgment." Svamaro, but dear. Is that reviewing the angels? I thought it was reviewing us normal people on low.
Good. Right. Who is being judged? And I would say in the first part of the poem, it is true that the people or the beings that are up for judgment are angels. Now I want to sort of play this out for 1 second, and maybe with this we'll transition to how I think the poem works. That is to say, what's the way to read this poem? And not only this poem, but all of the Piyutim sort of function in general in the way that I'm going to sort of argue here, which is to say, there is always a text that stands behind the references in the poem, so that the images that come up in the poem are not just their own images that we could connect to, like mi yichyeh mi yamut, who shall live and who shall die, but also, where do those phrases show up, either in the Bible or in rabbinic literature, that also add additional resonances to them. And the angels thing, I want to play out with that for 1 second, because it's a great part of the poem, which I think is often overlooked. So, Lifkod al tzva marom, how is it translated here? The hosts on high. I said this summer. It's like, until embarrassingly recently, I used to think that the translation of hosts was like, a host, like, you know, Bob Barker. He's a host on high, you know? But actually, tzva means army, okay? So wherever, like, the English, however English ended up translating army as host, you have to think army here, okay? So this is the heavenly army that's being played out here.
But we're not the heavenly army.
We are not, correct.
But aren't we the ones who are being judged?
Apparently, there are more beings on Judgment Day here than just us. So let's see how this plays out. Now, so I'm like 10 lines down, 10, 11 lines down in the Hebrew and in the English, and a great shofar will be sounded. Ubishofar gadol yitaka. Now, when is a great shofar sounded? Mashiach, right? We know this from the other part of the Amidah that we say every day. Tika b'shofar gadol l'cheiruteinu. Tika b'shofar gadol is the same as u'b'shofar gadol yitaka. A great shofar is sound. That is to say, it's not that long shofar over there with the awesome trumpet player who's going to sound the shofar this year. It's the ultimate shofar blast that brings the end of time. And at the end of time, who is being judged? The angels. Now, you can see this play out. Now, we were saying in this chavruta over here, well, wait a minute. If angels are judged, I thought angels are perfect. That's the one thing that I know about angels. So they actually don't have any bad deeds. So that's not really a great judgment, meaning they should do pretty well, right? If they have no ability to sin. However, that's not the only opinion here. And I want to sort of just work this out with you. So take a look back in the poem where it says, "Ubishofar gadol yitaka." The next line reads, "V'kol dimama daka yishama." Kol dimama daka. How would you translate that? Yeah, the still small voice often is translated, or here, the thin whisper of a sound. But you'll notice that daka is in brackets. That's because if you were to look at the good manuscript tradition of these of this poem, actually it's not there. It just said, and you can, and it works better with the meter. Ubishofar gadol yitaka, v'kol dimama yishama. Okay? So, if it's kol dimama daka, the still small voice, that takes us to one biblical reference, which is the story of Elijah, right? Where God sort of appears in the or makes a big sound, big lightning, you know, very sort of God-like experiences, almost revelation resonance. And then God says, but God isn't in the thunder. God isn't in the lightning. God isn't in the storm. God is in the still small voice, okay? Which is a lovely part of the Bible and an amazing spiritual teaching, but not what the poem is actually quoting. It's quoting a different part of the Bible, which is much scarier, if that's possible to imagine, which is the story in Job. You want to open up a horror book, check out Job, page 5. Okay. This is just what's the mood of the poem and why are we judging angels, okay? So I'm in Job 4, at the top of page 5, Job 4, chapter 4, verse 12. A word came to me in stealth. My ear caught a whisper of it. In thought-filled visions of the night, when deep sleep falls on men, fear and trembling came upon me, causing all my bones to quake with fright. This is the violins in the horror movie are starting to, you know, sound more wildly now, okay? A wind passed by me, making the hair of my flesh bristle. Right? My hair stood on end. It halted. Its appearance was strange to me. A form loomed before my eyes. Okay, this is like I'm seeing a ghost or something, right? What happens? Dimama vakol eshma. I heard a murmur, a voice. Vakol dimama yishama. Dimama vakol eshma. And here's what the voice says. You want to know what the thin, small voice says? But it's not the thin, small voice. It's just the small voice. Can mortals be acquitted by God? Can man be cleared by his maker? If he cannot trust his own servants, right, the angels, and cast reproach on his angels, how much less those who dwell in houses of clay, whose origin is dust, who are crushed like the moth, shattered between daybreak and evening, perishing forever unnoticed. Their cord is pulled up and they die, and not without wisdom. This is scary, right? Angels are being judged. And if angels are trembling on this day of judgment, you better believe that there's no chance for me. Okay? So the impact of the beginning of the poem, I want to argue to you, is this is terrifying. And I would even back it up one more reference, which is the very beginning of the poem itself, which is the words, Unetane Tokef. Gabi already pointed out sort of the intensity of that opening. Unetane Tokef, who let's attest to the power, or the modern Hebrew, hatkafa, is an attack. There's some sort of violent imagery that's associated with this. I'm going to attest to the power of God. Well, where does this come up? So let's just look at another horror story, page 3. It's going to get better, okay? Don't leave early. You're going to be depressed, okay? Page 3, the story of Yiftach. You remember the story of Yiftach?
Yes.
Yiftach was one of the judges, okay, in the book of Judges, who says, I am going to wage battle against Israel's enemies, and what I'm going to do to make sure that I'm going to win is I'm going to make a vow that whatever comes out of my house, if I win, I will sacrifice to God. Okay? This is not going to end well, okay? It's not going to be Rover. So Yiftach, so I'm on the bottom of page 3. And Yiftach made the following vow to God: if you deliver the Ammonites into my hands, whatever comes out of the door of my house to meet me on my safe return from the Ammonites shall be God's and shall be offered by me as a burnt offering. Okay? Skip down to verse 34. When Yiftach arrived at his home in Mitzpah, there was his daughter coming out to meet him with timbrel and dance. She was an only child. He had no other son or daughter. 35, on seeing her, he rent his clothes and said, "Alas, daughter, you've brought me low. You've become my troubler, for I have uttered a vow to Hashem and I cannot retract." And she says back to him, oh, come on. She says back to him, "Father," she said, "you've uttered a vow to Hashem. Do to me as you have vowed, seeing that Hashem has vindicated you against your enemies, the Ammonites. You have to make good on your vow. It worked. So yes, you should slaughter me, deliver me to Hashem." She said further to her father, "Let this be done for me. Let me be for 2 months. I'll go with my companions and lament upon the hills and there bewail my maidenhood." "Go," he replied. He let her go for 2 months. She and her companions went and bewailed her maidenhood upon the hills. After 2 months' time, she returned to her father, and he did to her as he had vowed. There's no angel coming out and saying, "Hold back your hand from slaughtering your child." This is the fulfillment of the vow. Okay, Yiftach does this to his only child. She had never known a man. Coda, so it became the custom in Israel for the maidens of Israel to go every year for 4 days in the year and chant dirges, litanot, unitana tokef. The word litanot comes almost never in the Bible. It comes about 5 times in the Bible. So you can pick the one that you want to have it resonate with. But for me, when I think about Yiftach's actions, this is not a vengeful God who, you know, decrees something. This is Yiftach using words to trip himself up and make significant errors in the way he behaves. And I think, obviously, so much of Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur is about how we use our words. And this is an extreme example with extreme results. But that's part of what I'm trying to argue. The beginning of this poem is scary. Hunitane. That's Yiftach. The vows. The things that I'm tripping up by saying, but with my own words. Then you have the Kol Demama Yishama. The angels are terrified. There's no way I'm going to make it out of here. Okay? So this is the beginning of the poem. You want to say? But I think actually you can read the poem more than just as a horror poem. And while it does begin as horror, I think it moves in other places. And this is where I want to go back to the question that I asked in the beginning, the literary question of, why does the author of the poem take the word mivatlin to cancel the gezerah kasha, the harsh decree, and substitute it with another word of ma'avirin? Okay? That is to say, when I say demama v'kol eshma, that's the same as kol demama yishama. All the words are the same. I'm quoting one, and I know you're going to get to the other. But when I use a different word, when I use the word ma'avirin instead of mivatlin, I think the poet is actually trying to signal something else, which is to say, pay attention to the word that changes. In other words, you expect to hear the word livatel, but instead you hear the word ma'avirin. And that, I think, is part of the literary approach to reading this poem, which is to say, there is a word the poet wants you to pay attention to. By shifting the word you would expect to hear to the word he gives you, he's having you focus on that word itself. Now, the word ma'avirin is from the root, what's the root of ma'avirin? Avar, which means what? Okay, so it means pass. What else does it mean? Cross. Like me'aver hanar, from across the river came my father, Abraham's ancestors. What else does it mean? This root. Sin, right? An avera. Okay? What else does it mean? To pass over. To pass over, right? Over. Over al pesha, we saw. To pass over crime. That's also pass over. Like, also sin is like transgress. Right? To cross. Okay? Yeah, Josh? Was it? Right, a tavera, right, is a burning, right, is some sort of fire. Good, yeah, what else?
To push off?
Like, omavir yom mevila, to cause to pass, like, right, to push off. To push off. Anything else? Yeah?
To ignore, right?
To ignore? Say, how does it work?
Like, to ignore. I think that's used in the context of music, but that might be done. Okay.
I want to think about it more. How about this? What's this word? Ubar. A fetus. Right? Le'aber hashana. To intercalate the year. English words that don't really translate Hebrew. Phylacteries, tabernacle, Leviticus. Okay, so to intercalate means to add another word, to add another month. Okay? But that's in Hebrew, le'aber hashana is because this root also means a fetus. Okay? To conceive. Okay? So this is a significant word. Oh, by the way, it also means one other thing. What are we called?
Hebrew.
Hebrew is of Ivri. Ivrim. We are the people who these things. Okay? Right? We are the people who cross. We're the crossers. We're the transgressors. We're the fetuses. We're the sinners. Right? It's all, this is what Hebrew means. Tell that to the Hebrew brilliant marketing of a beer. But still, it's like Ma'oz. If you ever been to Ma'oz, if you ever read their materials, what is the first thing they say? What does Ma'oz mean? It doesn't actually have any real meaning. No, it does. It means strong in Hebrew. Anyways, Hebrew means something, okay? So what I'm trying to argue is that the poet is highlighting the root avar as a way of opening up different ways of experiencing God through the poem. And if you're going to count the number of times that the root avar shows up in the poem, Ma'avirina Rogzera is one of them, but there are six others that I could count, a total of seven, which is not a bad literary unit if you're going for that kind of thing, okay? So what I want to do with you is look at the ways in which the root avar shows up in the poem as a way of opening up different theological pictures of how God can behave on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. Okay? That is to say, it's not just the scary God in the first, 15 lines of the poem. There's other ways that God presents as well, and they're subtler, but I think we can open them up through this connecting of the poem to this source quotes by looking at the places where this root is called in the poem. You ready to do that?
Yeah.
We're going to do it? Molly? Go.
Actually, no, I'm really curious. How did you know it wasn't referring to the still small voice from Elijah? The more heartening
word. Only because the word daka, which appears in Elijah, actually isn't in the poem, in the best manuscripts of the poem.
Oh, in terms of, okay, so it's more.
So it's just, it's literally which verse are they quoting? Well, only the one where all the words are there. Except what I'm saying, Ma'avirin, when they say, it's quoting this Midrash, but actually it's changing this one word. Oh, now he's actually doing it intentionally in order to highlight this root. So let's see where the root shows up. Okay, we're going to just, we may or may not do all of them, but let's just look at some of them, okay? Right after what David noticed, Lifkod al Tzva Maron Badim, reviewing the hosts on high in judgment. So back to page one, couple lines below that. V'chol ba'ei olam yavrun lefanecha kivnei maron. All the ba'ei olam, all those who enter the world, that is to say, not just Jews, by the way, all humans, all creatures, yavrun lefanecha, shall pass before you, kivnei maron. Now, this is a famous manuscript problem with this source quote, which we'll see in a second, which is, what does b'nei maron mean? Either it means sheep, and there are some sheep images that come in the next couple of lines. Or it's one word, which is numeron, which is the Greek way of saying a group of soldiers. And it seems like in all the Mishnayot, it comes from a Mishnah, it's referring to a group of soldiers. So if I say to you, well let's just look at the source quote. Flip over to page 5, text number 3, okay? So this is in the Mishnah, the oldest rabbinic law code of dealing with the laws of Rosh Hashanah, and it says, "Be'arba prakim ha'olam nidon." three times a year is the world judged. Pesach for agricultural produce. Shavuot for the fruit of the trees. That's when you bring Bikurim. On Rosh Hashanah, all the world, Kol Ba'e Olam, Ovrim Lefanav Kivnei Maron. All the world passes before him like a flock of sheep or in military formation. As it says, he who fashions the hearts of them all, who discerns all their deeds. Right? If I know your deeds, I'm judging you. And it's all of them, right? On Sukkot, they're judged on the water. Now you can see here, it's a little bit of the Sesame Street game of which of these things is not like the other. So you've got Pesach, Shavuot, and Sukkot. They look like they're in a group. Okay? That makes sense. And they are the three pilgrim festivals. But Rosh Hashanah shows up different, and it's not about a particular aspect of the world's produce that's being judged, but actually we are all being judged on Rosh Hashanah. Okay? Now, if I say to you, God is the kind of judge who's reviewing you like military formation, what is the way in which you get through that judgment? How do I pass through the judgment of God reviewing me like a group of soldiers?
Just stay in step.
Stay in step. Right? If I stand out, that's not going to work. Yeah? What else? Yeah?
Well, I'm thinking of like uniform inspections and military barracks, right? Like your shirt's untucked when you see all the uniform.
Yes. Good. External things matter, right? How do you appear? Do you march out of step? Are your boots shiny enough? Right? And you don't, it's not like, hey, let me give you some friendly advice about how your shirt is untucked. It's drop and give me 20, right? This is not a friendly review, yeah?
I think there's also, we were talking about this a little bit, because it's very much like that with the image of the sheep crossing over, that everyone is the same and you don't feel like you want to be the same as all the other sheep, but I actually think there's something really nice about that image too, where my sins are no better or worse than...
Good. Okay, you're saying, you know what, there's something to be said for all, like, sort of blending in together. Asham knew... It's not like I'm a terrible person and you're great. We're actually kind of equalized in some way.
That it uses the word avar and, you know, we're avar yani, right? That like they're all sinners.
We're all sinners, right? We've all transgressed. Okay, good. Now, I think this is actually, whether you like the imagery or you don't like the imagery, this is not something that's foreign to us about Rosh Hashanah. If I was going to say, draw me a picture of God in judgment, if someone handed you a drill sergeant reviewing the soldiers, you'd be like, yeah, okay. Maybe it would have had a long beard, but still pretty close, right? So this is, I would say, in the realm of images of God that the beginning of the poem gives us. It's scary. You don't want to stand out. Maybe you're sort of finding comfort in numbers, but it's not a place in which my own individuality is being recognized, okay? And the God who's reviewing me is not necessarily the kind and loving judge, but more of the Emet and Deen kind of judge, okay? That's your first Avar image. But the line continues from there. So we're just going to do a little bit of going back and forth from the poem. So just go back to the poem again. We're in the line right below where we started. So V'chol Ba'e Olam Yavrun Lefanav Kivnei Maron, that is reviewing like military formation. That's the first Avar. You can underline it if you want. Now the second one, next line. Kivakarat Ro'eh Edro, Ma'avir tsono tachat shivto. Like a shepherd searches for his flock, passing a sheep under his staff. Okay? This is two references bundled up into one sentence. So I want to look at each one because they're different and they're helpful, I think. So we'll look at the first reference. Kivakarat ro'eh edro. Like a shepherd who is searching for his flock. So this is a quote from Ezekiel. Turn over to page 5. Now you're saying to yourself, how am I supposed to know where all these things come from? Like, I don't have the source sheet with me for the Machzor, but this is the style. Meaning, whether or not we are aware of it, this is how these poems were constructed. And you can't fully understand them unless you understand the references that are being played out here. Yes, you'll come back next year, and we'll do other piyutim. And at the end, we'll have unlocked the whole Machzor. But this is just sort of a model of how you might understand these poems, even if we're not doing all the work before Rosh Hashanah this year. Okay, bottom of page 5. Tell me who you identify with in this story. Okay, this is Ezekiel raging in prophecy. And he says, the word of Hashem came to me. O mortal, prophesy against the shepherds of Israel. Prophesy and say to them, to the shepherds, thus says the Lord God, Ah, you shepherds, turn the page, of Israel, who have been tending yourselves. Is it not the flock that the shepherds ought to tend? You partake of the fat. You clothe yourselves with the wool. You slaughter the fatlings, but you do not tend the flock. You've not, now he breaks out of the metaphor. You've not sustained the weak, healed the sick, or bandaged the injured. You've not brought back the strayed or looked for the lost, but you have driven them with harsh rigor. Okay? Not a good shepherd, right? Just taking advantage of the flock, not searching out and taking care. Moses was selected as a leader of our people because he was chasing, according to Midrash, chasing that one sheep who ran away. That's not the shepherds that you see here. These are the ones who are enriching themselves off the flock and not doing any work to care for the vulnerable or the sick or the needy. Okay? Now, skip down to verse 10, the last box on page 6. Thus says the Lord God, I am going to deal with the shepherds. I will demand a reckoning of them for my flock, and I will dismiss them from tending the flock. You're fired. The shepherds shall not tend themselves anymore, for I will rescue my flock from their mouths, and it shall not be their prey. For thus says the Lord God, here I am. I am Hineni. I am going to take thought for my flock, and I will seek them out. Here's our line. Kivakarat roe edro. As a shepherd seeks out his flock when some in his flock have gotten separated, so I will seek out my flock. I will rescue them from all the places to which they were scattered on a day of cloud and gloom. Now, who are you standing with in this scene? You identify with the shepherd?
Or I'm saying we are being called the shepherd.
So the shepherds of Israel here are not all of Israel, but rather the leaders of Israel. Right? This is the day in which corrupt leaders get judged. Anyone want to see that day? Are you with me? Looking forward to Rosh Hashanah? Okay? Right? We're the sheep are the victims. I am a sheep. I'm not the shepherd. Right? I mean, who knows? But this is where the corrupt leader gets called to account, and the day of judgment is something that is a freeing day for all those people who've been abused by the corrupt leaders who've been left in charge too long. And on the day of judgment here, God steps in and says, you know what? I'm the true leader, and you are not going to be in charge and take advantage of the weak anymore. I'm going to rescue those wandering sheep that are led astray. So now I say to you, the day of judgment is coming. The day of judgment is near. You're like, great. Can it come a little sooner? You know, I'm more than ready. But that's only in a situation which who's being judged? The corrupt leaders. Okay? Kivakarat roe edro. Now that's different from we are all soldiers and we are being judged all together, all at once, all of humanity. This is just a particular group of sinners who God can replace because they have been corrupt and not seeking out the rest of the sheep. Now, one more image on this same line. So we had Kivakarat roe edro, Ma'avir tsono tachat shivto, who causes to pass his sheep under his shebet, under his staff. Now this comes from a different part of the Bible, from Vayikra, from Leviticus. So turn over to page 7. Top of page 7. This one I think is perhaps the most radical and either comforting or disturbing. You'll tell me how you feel about it. Okay? This is the last law in the book of Leviticus about the tithe, the tenth animal that you're meant to give to God, to the temple. All tithes of the herd or flock of all that passes under the shepherd's staff, kol asher ya'avor tachet hashevet, right? Ma'avir tzono tachet shivto, whatever passes under the shepherd's staff, every tenth one shall be holy to Hashem. Okay? So you're counting out. How do I tithe? I count out the number 10. Now, the most amazing thing is the next sentence. Okay? The next sentence says, Lo yivaker bein tov lara. You may not make a distinction between good or bad. Right? That is to say, you want to give 10% of your flock to God? I get it. But I want to give a little bit of the runty ones over here. I'm willing to part with those. Or you're pious and you say, I want to give the best of my sheep to God. Right? What does Leviticus tell you? Lo yivaker, you may not distinguish between good and bad, and you may not make a substitution for it. And if you do make a substitution, I counted them out, this one's number 10, but actually I want to send this one. If you try to do that, then it and its substitute shall both be holy. then you've actually given 20%. Because the original one you counted cannot be undone. It cannot be redeemed. These are the commandments that, this is the last pasuk in Vayikra, these are the commandments that God gave Moses for the Israelite people on Mount Sinai. Okay? So now you have an image where this is not about judging everybody as equal soldiers, and not about judging the corrupt leaders, but how does judgment work here? Totally random. It's totally random. It's not about good. It's not about bad. You can't make distinctions on good. You're not allowed to make distinctions. You try to make distinctions, they're going to tax you for it. Yeah, I'll take that one too, right? But this is about random selection. Now, that's not something that is, I would say, front and center on the theology of Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. It's all about your deeds, right? If you behave well, you get into this book. You don't behave well, you're in that book. But this is, I think, opening up some reference. Again, you can take it or leave it, but opening up some reference to the randomness of life, where good and bad just don't play in to who gets marked as Kodesh. Yeah.
There's some, I mean, in Yom Kippur, there's a goral on the goats. That's kind of random. I mean, that's by definition random.
Good, right. There's a lottery on the goats, on the two goats on Yom Kippur, although neither of them end up living. So in that way, it's about, are you going to die now or are you going to die in 3 hours? But I would say there is a randomness, not like this goat gets to be slaughtered in the temple and this goat, Nebuch, gets pushed off the rocks because it was worse. Right, so there's sort of like the randomness element that there is there as well, which is interesting. Yeah, Josh.
I actually really appreciate that sort of diversity perspective that's in there. In a sort of different way, but very, very parallel, when the rabbis are like discussing suffering and why people suffer in the world, there's like a whole host of options that are kind of presented. Like there are opinions in the Gemara that suggest that you should look at like whether you're doing mitzvot, and like you should look at like all these different things, like an action-based thing. And then there are other opinions that are like, well, it's actually something because of your parents and their deeds and like this sort of an image of the world. And then there are other opinions that are like, God decrees from on high what he decrees. And then there are others that are like, it's sufferings of love. Like, it's because God loves you. It's like you couldn't get a more diverse set of like visions of how sort of this, the theodicy plays out. And it's like, in some ways that's great because that allows for like perhaps different approaches and different moments and thinking about this where I want to focus on the image of like, I am coronating God and I am coming to this day having done the work and in full confidence that I am standing in front of you having done what I need to do this day. But I also might be one of those people who needs to fall in line. And I feel like that last piece where like, I don't know, is like sort of the balance between what's kind of necessary to say like, maybe I've been doing maybe I've actually made up for everything. Maybe I haven't, and better to sort of like kind of hold that tension and like walk that line between, yes, I'm gonna come with you with a balance of confidence and also humility such that like I like get accomplished the most, I get the most out of this.
Yeah, no, I think you're pointing something very important, which is that this poem represents a diversity of opinions around the whole question of judgment that is not a stranger to the rabbinic project in general. That is to say, it's not that, oh, there's one way in which they view and the poem sort of deviates in a radical move that no one else has ever thought of. It's like, yeah, some of this stuff is floating around in rabbinic thought as well, and the poem is just sort of, in this reading, is bringing them together. Okay, and you can recite the poem with all these images together being held because maybe, I don't know, one of them speaks to you this year in a way that the other doesn't, or this speaks to me a little bit, etc. That's, again, this is, I leave it to you to make your own connection to any of these images, but just to say this is how the poem works. The poem is not a singular way, not a singular approach, not the scary vision that the beginning of the poem brings out, but actually multiple approaches. Can I just do two more with you quick in our last few minutes together? So when you get to the who shall live and who shall die, right? How does that list start out? It says, so I'm still on page 1, 5 from the bottom. Kama ya'avrun, V'kama yibareim. How many shall pass on? That's a decent translation, right? Meant to indicate die. He passed away, right? Kama yavrun. V'kama yibareim. And how many will be created? Mi yichye umi yamut. Who shall live and who shall die? Mi bekitzo, mi lo bekitzo. Who at the end of his days and who not at the end of his days? Who by water, who by fire? Now, if you run down these, Benjamin's already asking, well, how does this list put together? One way to read it is to say, the better thing is at the beginning. Right? Like, yichye, living is better than dying. And living out the end of your days is better than not living out the end of your days. And actually, fire is the worst death in rabbinic imagination. Burning is the absolute worst punishment. So water is better than fire. Not great choices, but still, okay? Meaning, but the first one is backwards, right? It's also not me, it's kama, right? So what I'm saying is that this is intentional by the poet to say, I'm making you pay attention to the word that sticks out. That is, the word avar comes out and sticks out again. I should have said kama yibareun and kama yavrun, but I reversed it in a way of highlighting this word or this root for you. Now, you can actually read, this was a suggestion by Avram Berliner in the late 19th century. He was a German scholar who said, you know what? You don't actually have to read it as how many shall pass on, meaning how many shall die, but you could actually read it with the ubar understanding, the fetus understanding of the word, kama yi'abrun, how many will be conceived. And then you could read it actually as the cycle of life. How many will be conceived? How many will be created, i.e. born? Mi yichyeh, who will live? That is to say, who will make it out of the very precarious first 30 days of life, especially in the ancient world? Umi yamut, and who won't? Right? Where you can see, and then it's not about reversing AB to BA, but rather about a longer chain. But I think what's significant for me here is that the word avar can both mean to die and to be born. That's pretty opposite, right? But it's both of them are passing. You're passing into life, you're passing out of life, right? And in that way, this word is such a significant word to hold on to as we approach the high holidays, the Yamim Noraim, because it sort of holds the key to what this season is about to remind us of, transitions. Are we making the ultimate transition from alive to dead or dead to alive, whichever way that's going, or some other sort of, lower level transition? That's part of what's being played out here. Now you get to already tshuva tefillah tzedakah ma'avirin erog, you're like, ma'avirin. In case you didn't get it till now, that's the word I'm supposed to be paying attention to. Now I want to look at one last place where avar shows up, the root avar, which is in a great list here. In the middle of page 2, this is another sort of an ode to people who are mortal. Adam yisodo me'afar. A person's origin is from dust. Right in the middle of page 2. A person's origin is from dust and his end is dust. At their peril gathering food, like, and here's a bunch of similes about how vulnerable human life is. Shattered pottery, withered grass, faded blossom, passing shadow, tsel over, right? A passing shadow, vanishing cloud, blowing wind, floating dust, like a dream that will fly away. But you are king, everlasting God. Now, there are two references that I want to look at to close here. One is the way in which this shows up in the Bible, and the one is the way, an amazing, amazing story, which is how the rabbis read this contrast between dust and ashes of people and God as the El Melech Chai V'Kayam, as the ultimate king. Okay, so first is the one from Psalms. Now, if I say to you, I am a passing shadow. You know what? I'm a passing shadow. On the self-esteem meter, not hitting super high, right? I'm a passing shadow. Now, let's take a look at how this shows up in Psalms. All right, so flip over with me to page 8. Adam lahevel dama. A person is like Hevel, is like vapor. It's interesting, Adam's son was named Hevel. Pro tip, don't name your child vapor if you want him to have a long life in the Bible, okay? Adam lahevel dama, a person is like vapor. Yamav ketzel over, his days are like a passing shadow. Not bullish on human longevity. But now, listen to how the psalm moves. O Lord, bend your sky and come down. Touch the mountains and they will smoke. Make lightning flash and scatter them. Shoot your arrows and rout them. Reach your hand down from on high. Rescue me, save me from the mighty waters, from the hands of foreigners. So on the one hand, it's, I'm nothing. I'm a passing shadow. I'm vapor. But God, if you could just change the laws of nature and come down and save me, that would be great, right? Like, I'm, you know, it's look who thinks he's nothing, okay? It's like, I'm nothing, but really, I actually want you to relate to me, to save me, to connect to me. So on the one hand, I'm saying I'm like a passing shadow, but I don't really totally mean it in the way of, like, I don't think that's the ultimate value of my own life, is as a passing shadow. I don't have to take that at face value. Now, that's the way you could read it from the Bible. But I want to end with this amazing midrash from Echa Rabbah, where they take it, you know what? I'm dust and ashes, but you, God, you're the everlasting king. Now, you can take that and say, this is the story of humanity. We are frail, mortal, you know, not impactful. God is eternal, and God is the ultimate, and God is everything, and we are nothing. Right? That's not an unreasonable conclusion to draw from the theology of the Matzar. But check out this Midrash. Just, this will be your gift going into Rosh Hashanah. Okay? This is in a series of Midrashim that are trying to figure out, can the Jewish people be saved through the merits of their ancestors? And they try, they put up for trial, oh, maybe Abraham has enough merits. Well, actually, he had a few sins. Isaac, no, not really. Jacob, Joseph, they're moving through all the way until they get to the women. Now you see we're reaching to the bottom. Rachel. Rachel steps in, and based on this verse in Jeremiah, Rachel cries over her children. She is the merit that saves Israel. This midrash gives you the reason why Rachel is meritorious to save the Jewish people. And this is because the night of Rachel's wedding, she has a different idea. If you remember, Rachel is not supposed to marry Jacob, right? Jacob is given to Leah. He doesn't know this. But Leah is the woman he's supposed to marry because she's older. And Rachel, he has to work another 7 years in order to get that marriage done. But Rachel knew this was coming and had these special signs that she had shared with Jacob and said, I know my father's going to try to trick you. So when it's time for me to be married to you, if I don't give you the signs, then it's my sister Leah. Don't do it. Okay? But then Rachel decides in an act of sisterly love to give the signs to Leah. Okay? So she reverses the scheme. At that moment, Rachel, our mother, jumped before God and said, on bottom page 8, jumped before God and said, Master of the universe, it's known to you that Jacob, your servant, loved me a great love and worked for me with my father for 7 years. But when those 7 years ended and the time of our marriage arrived, my father decided to switch me for my sister Leah. This was very hard for me, for I found out about the plan. I told it to Jacob, my husband-to-be, and I gave him a secret sign that he would be able to distinguish between me and my sister, so my father would not be able to switch us. But later, I regretted my decision. I think this is like a very powerful emotional move. I regretted my decision. I suffered through my desire and had mercy on my sister. Okay? Instead of loving the man and marrying the man that I wanted, and we had our whole plan worked out, instead I had mercy on my sister that she would not be ashamed. On the evening of our wedding, I switched with my sister. I gave my sister the secret sign so that Jacob would think it was me. And not only that, but I hid under the bed. And when he would speak, I would answer so that he wouldn't know it was my sister. Weren't you wondering how Jacob woke up in the morning and was like, oh my God, it's Leah. What was happening during the night? Okay, now we know. Listen to the kicker. And so I did chesed with my sister, and I was not jealous of her, and I did not shame her. And I, Uma Ani, Shani Basar Vadam Afar Vaefer, I who am just flesh and blood, dust and ashes, was not jealous of my sister and didn't cause her shame. You, Viata, Melech Chai V'Kayam, but you who are the everlasting king, why are you jealous of idols? Immediately God's mercy was aroused and God said, because of you, Rachel, I'll return Israel to their place. Right? So when I'm saying, I am dust and ashes, but you are everlasting king, imagine reading this Midrash where you're Rachel making the claim, you know what? I'm actually not too bad. And I did an act of loving kindness for my sister that is really hard for me. But I'm nothing. You, who are everlasting, the least you could do is pardon the Jewish people. Right? And all that is wrapped up into the poem that we're reciting. On the surface of, we're saying, you know, who shall live and who shall die, but also not just under the surface, we're saying, you know what? We can actually make it through this together. And because of the chesed that we experience, there's some possibility for our own redemption. We'll stop here. Happy Rosh Hashanah.